Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 1:52 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 8th. I thought we'd kick off with the ratio between Bitcoin and gold, because Bitcoin really did outperform in a very impressive manner all the way through from September through to the beginning of December. And since then, it has stopped. So that's a significant development. There has obviously been some form of rotation. What I find particularly interesting is when we start to look at the timing of media reports versus the performance of the ratio. Nobody was talking about the possible rotation of investors out of gold and into Bitcoin back in September. In fact, just as gold peaked at the end of August, there were very few people talking about Bitcoin at all. Whereas in the space of the last couple of weeks, we've had a great deal of talk about the number of central bank net selling, which hasn't really been a factor since 2011, and even then it was only on a very short-term basis. And we've also heard about the quantity of money that's coming out of gold-backed ETFs, and then the supposition that it's moving into Bitcoin. But what we now see is that the ratio does look like it has at least got a loss of momentum, that we have a failed upside break, and coming back down to the 10 level, that's just a little bit short of a midpoint danger line stop. So then the question is, are we now actually seeing a rotation out of Bitcoin and back into gold? And one thing that I'm rather comforted by in terms of thinking about that as a potential scenario is that no one else is talking about it. So by the time we swing around to perhaps the end of January, are we then going to be looking at a point where people are questioning the validity of Bitcoin and thinking about the potential that gold is the only true store of value? And at that point, perhaps we could be in for another rotation. But I think it is worth simply just thinking about the ratio as we look at the absolute performance of some of these asset classes, because gold continues to rebound from the region of the trend mean, and now it is back above the $1,870 area, if only just, but more importantly than that, it is pushing back up into that overhead trading range. $1,900 had been both an area of support and then resistance, support between August and September, resistance in October and November. So it's going to be an important area for prices to surmount, and we still have this overall downward bias. It did look like that downward bias was going to be broken on a number of occasions in October and then again in November, only to be knocked straight back down again. So in order to truly confirm that we are indeed back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment rather than simply a short-term rebound, then it's going to have to at least sustain a move above the $1,900 area. Then when we think about Bitcoin, well, Bitcoin is right in the region of 20,000, and it is consolidating. It was at the end of November that we first got up to this level. It has now failed to push up to new highs. It's coming back into the underlying trading range. If we were to think about where a midpoint danger line stop would be, well, the lows are around 16,000. The highs are, the previous high was around 19,500. So half of 3,500 would be about 1,700 points. And it would take it down somewhere in here. So then we haven't really come anywhere close to triggering a midpoint danger line stop in Bitcoin just yet, but it is consolidating, and it is not all that surprising that we get some consolidation in the region of the previous peak. I remain very much of the opinion that while there are tenuous and the comparisons between gold and Bitcoin, and there are also questions about whether Bitcoin will ultimately win out as a viable financial system in its own right. But one thing that is quite clear is that the nature of trading and the way that people take positions and the emotionality of the markets are very similar. So Bitcoin investors are prone to extreme views. They are in it for short, sharp gains. They generally jump in on breakouts. That's really similar to what we see with Bitcoin. It's best bought following reactions, and we've just seen one of those in gold, and well, we haven't seen one in a while for Bitcoin. But one of the defining trend consistencies for Bitcoin has been that this isn't the first time that it has ranged for almost 3 years. And it also has a tendency to find support following major reactions in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It certainly did that back in 2015. It did it again in 2018 and earlier this year. The last time it broke out of a 3-year range, well, then it rallied in a very spectacular manner. That is the primary reason why people are interested in it right now. Now, quite whether we do in fact get a Santa Claus rally and it breaks out towards the end of this month remains to be seen. Certainly that was one of the reasons why people were supporting it on its way up towards the 20,000 level. The question at the time was whether it was going to consolidate in the region of the peak. I think we have our answer. It is definitely consolidating in the region of the peak. And so far, we haven't got evidence that that consolidation is over. Now, as we look at, well, what are the primary reasons why gold should be doing better? Well, we're in a negative real interest rate environment. Treasury yields had pulled back in early trading today, but closed pretty much unchanged. There's still a very clear upward bias, and I think it is more likely than not that we are eventually going to see a retest of the 1% level and an attempt for yields to push above it. When we think about what's going on in the high yield market, we've had a very significant contraction in spreads, and it is down now to 341 basis points, and that's really not all that far away from the narrows that we saw in 2017 and 18, all the way through to the beginning of this year. And in fact, if we go back and look at history over the course of the last 20 years, well, we've never seen the spread contract below 200 basis points. There have been occasions when it's spent a good few years ranging above the 250 basis point level, and that would suggest that there's about 90 basis points of fat that could be potentially carved off of spreads, but that it's unlikely we're going to see the 200 basis point level breached. But one thing that is quite clear is a large number of companies have been able to refinance this year, and they've taken the opportunity to increase their share load, take on debt, draw down credit lines, and all of that has been aimed at ensuring that they have got enough liquidity to tide them through any kind of solvency crisis as we move into 2021. It's very likely that there is a huge amount of pent-up demand in the economy, that there are large numbers of people who have got large quantities of savings. Obviously, a lot of the money that got pushed out into the economy was spent on real-time consumption, but then there will be plenty of people who use it to pay down debt and to pad their savings. That's certainly been one of the factors in the demand for housing, and it has allowed a large number of people to save the deposit so that they can get better terms on their mortgages. But it also means that people have got more savings, and as the pandemic eventually ends, then we are quite likely to see the potential for a lot more consumption. Well, that's good for high yield companies. They're likely to not see really a lot of pressure on their credit if demand starts to pick back up and businesses start to do better. Obviously, the very significant amount of money that has been borrowed and shares issued by companies has had a rather significant effect on the supply side. And maybe I already still have this chart open. I do. So when we think about, for example, a company like Tesla, Tesla is has been issuing quite a lot of shares this year, and it issued another $5 billion worth of shares just in here this week. Now, the share itself, the market cap, has done spectacularly well, obviously, over the course of the last decade, but most particularly this year, going from about $100 billion to $600 billion is really rather significant. But one thing that's, I think, rather interesting about Tesla is that the share price has gone up pretty much in tune with the market cap. And that's especially true if we just look over the last year, where we've had this really incredibly impressive advance. Now, when we think about other companies that had been buying back a lot of their shares rather than issuing shares, well, then we get, I think, some rather interesting phenomena. So, for example, if we look at Norwegian cruise lines, and I have been writing about that over the last couple of weeks, well, then the market cap has greatly exceeded the price recently, and that does reflect that supply has increased. And obviously, this also helps to highlight the leverage that some of these companies have taken on. Well, obviously, if companies are becoming more levered, then they absolutely need to deliver on revenue growth if they're going to survive. Excuse me, I'm just going to cough. Well, that's, I think, a significant factor. But when we think about supply and demand, supply is increasing and therefore it's a risk. But supply is a real-time a real-time fundamental factor. And demand is forward-looking. So as we look towards the future, the big question is supply going to continue to increase? And will demand growth outpace the increase in supply? Because if the demand growth does in fact come through, well, then the relative leverage of the company will decrease from elevated levels right now. We had the exact opposite scenario in a large number of companies before the pandemic, because they were buying back prodigious amounts of their shares, which resulted in financial engineering acting as a support for the price, because they were reducing the share count, and that was helping to support the market cap by increasing basic earnings per share. So then we can think about what's going on right now. It really is absolutely all down to whether demand does in fact keep up with the rise in supply. And more importantly, it would need to exceed it for the recovery to continue. But people are still willing to give the benefit of the doubt to recovery. And that's also what the high yield spread is telling us, that bond investors are looking at the high yield spreads, looking at the high yield market as still representing value, because the spread continues to contract. And the reason that they're willing to do that is because we're still in an incredibly liquid environment where governments all over the world are printing money they don't have and actively devaluing their currencies. So that's also the primary reason why the gold price is appreciating. But obviously the intent to devalue currencies is most particularly true in the developed markets. The emerging markets, particularly in Asia, are generally running less debt and have lower debt to GDP ratios and are coming out of the coronavirus pandemic in better shape. So the Asia dollar index remains on a clear recovery trajectory. When we look at the commodities complex, it's also rallying in a very similar manner. And copper prices in particular are at new recovery highs. We haven't seen highs like this in years. But the trend is very similar to the Asia dollar index. It bottomed in March and it hasn't really looked back. When we spin that out and simply look at the wider metals sector, then it is coming back up towards the peaks put in 2017 and 18. It looks increasingly likely that it is going to break on the upside. When we think about the metal miners, the FTSE 350 mining index has now cleared the 20,000 level and done so in a dynamic manner. So that's really rather encouraging. And last week was a big week for the sector. When we think about the BlackRock World Mining Trust, then it has been leading on the upside and it's benefiting from its discount to NAV. This looks like a clear recovery scenario. We've had the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. We had a lengthy period of right-hand extension and subsequently a first step above the base, and now it's breaking out. So this looks like a new trend, and it looks like a trend that has legs. I think one thing that I think is really quite relevant is that this trust, if we look at it over the long term, has got a very similar price trend to the continuous commodity index, although the trust has outperformed of late. So we're seeing that we've had a retest of the lows around 3,000, which was last seen in 2008, and now we are back in a liquidity-fueled environment where the number one priority of every government in the world is reflation. So there is going to be a clear set of policies put in place to try and get to reduce any kind of economic scarring, to revitalize growth, get people back to work, and more importantly for politicians to try and hold on to power. Obviously, in countries that have come through the pandemic in better form and have been able to remain open and maintain their industrial capacity and production, then they've done better. China is certainly one of those. They've come through in pretty robust form, and their trade surplus hit a record high relative to with the USA this month, and that is primarily because of the success of their quarantining. Of course, what they also did, which is just something that is not possible in other countries, is they confined workers to factories. So it is quite common in factories in China for people to live in residential complexes at the factory, and they were literally imprisoned in their factories, still working and not allowed to leave for prolonged periods of time. That ensured that production was kept on pace, but it also was a function of just how authoritarian the country is. And with the vindication of that authoritarian stance, it is extremely unlikely that China is going to back down from that kind of authoritarian regime. It's one of the biggest challenges that the world is likely to face over the next decade, because as Milton Friedman used to say, there's nothing so permanent as a temporary government policy. And governments have learned that they can control populations through fear. And it doesn't necessarily have to be existential fear, but simply a fear of risking particularly for people that are my age. I mean, I can understand that people would be rather fearful if they were over 60, or more particularly if they were over 80. Then they only have a 1, or they have only have a 9 out of 10 chance of surviving. People my age have got a 99 out of 100% chance of surviving. And yet we have got people that are fearful about leaving their homes. This is obviously a sign of some form of hysteria, something that is going to inform the social condition for a prolonged period. But at the same time, people are thirsting for social interaction. It is very likely that we're going to have a surge back into social interaction as we move out of this pandemic. And I remain very much of the opinion that we are going to be massively oversupplied with vaccines by the time we get to the middle of 2021, much less the end of 2021. Therefore, the big question is going to be about inflation. The one thing that, if I was in government and I was looking at everything that's transpired in 2020, I would be thinking about what I've learned. And the first thing that would pop to mind is that you can spend as much money as you want without any real repercussions. But if you've been a politician for the last decade, the one thing you've learned is that as soon as you try to take that liquidity away, then you spark massive popular protests, the rise of populism and extreme political parties, massive threats to the status quo and a threat to their grasp on power. So the clear lesson for politicians is just spend the money and worry about the problems later. And unfortunately, that is going to be anathema to anyone with even a modicum of fiscal responsibility. But it's the lesson that politicians have learned. So we are likely to see continued and extraordinary spending. And that's why commodities are doing well. It's why emerging markets are doing well. And it's also why highly levered companies continue to recover, because we're in an extraordinarily liquid environment. And as long as government bond yields remain contained, but most particularly as long as high yield spreads are contained, well, then we're still going to be in a liquidity-rich environment. The reality is that governments are actively devaluing currencies. And the best way to think about that is that it is a stealth default. And since that is what's going on, that's why gold is doing well. And gold is likely to continue to do well as long as that remains a threat, and it's likely to remain a threat for the foreseeable future. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.